Ambassador Chas Freeman, so nice to have you back on this podcast.
Glad to be here.
Let's get started with the conflict in Gaza and the situation in the West Bank right now. It seems that Israelis are intensifying their attack on the West Bank. What's going on in your opinion?
Well, I think if you remember right after October 7th, when Hamas and other Palestinians broke out of the concentration camp in Gaza and committed atrocities in neighboring areas of Israel, one of the Israelis referred to what was going to happen as Nakba version 2.0. In other words, this was seen by some in Israel as an opportunity to complete the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, which is the basic premise of Zionism. You remember that Zionism began by declaring that there was a land without people for a people without land, namely the newly invented Jewish people, who had been a religion and had suddenly become a nationality. Well, inconveniently, there turned out to be people there, Palestinians. And in the first Nakba in 1948, some 700,000, over 50% of the then population were scared, frightened, terrorized into leaving. Ever since then, Israel has been trying to finish that job, and usually by more less visible, less shocking methods. But in Gaza, it is carrying out a campaign of extermination of the residents. We know that, contrary to the figure that's usually bandied about, probably something over 200,000 Palestinians have been killed. 100,000 or so have been seriously wounded. There are people under the rubble who will never be found. At the moment, about 20% of the population is on the brink of death through starvation. This is an opportunity for Israel. The world is focused on what it's doing in Gaza, and it's taking the opportunity to accelerate the ethnic cleansing of the West Bank. It's all part of one pattern. Israel will not be comfortable until Jews are supreme in all of Palestine, and non-Jewish residents of Palestine have been reduced to a minority small enough to be inconsequential, perhaps the 20% figure of Arabs still living in pre-1967 Israel, Arab citizens, who are treated as second-class citizens, but who are spared most of the savagery that's being meted on Palestinians in other parts of the territory. I think this represents, in other words, the actions in the West Bank that you refer to represent a very significant escalation of the ethnic cleansing effort by Israel. And we don't know where it will stop. So far, there is, I think, no effective opposition to it from outside Israel. And most Israelis, according to polls, support it.
Is Netanyahu trying to gain more support from Israel because of this type of attitude in the West Bank?
Well, I saw a recent poll from, I think, Channel 4 in Israel, which suggested that if an election were held now, Netanyahu's Likud party would get 30 seats in the Knesset, and other extremist parties, right-wing parties, would sweep the board. So clearly what he's doing is very popular among Israelis, I think the answer is yes.
And the other thing was this preemptive attack of Israelis on Hezbollah, and they were talking about that was successful, and Nasrallah responded that it wasn't successful. How did you find this preemptive attack and the response coming from Hezbollah?
Well, my understanding is that Israel did bomb many areas in Lebanon for about 20 minutes very early on Sunday morning, but I don't think it hit anything very much. Hezbollah has always been very honest in its acknowledgement of casualties. I believe it acknowledged two casualties. One or two missiles may have been actually destroyed, or perhaps they were drones rather than missiles. On the Israeli sides, very interestingly and suggestively, at 5 o'clock in the morning, right after this attack, the Israeli government issued an order that there should be no reporting whatsoever in any channel about the damage that it had suffered in the Hezbollah attack, which Hezbollah has described as vengeance for the murder of Fuad Shukr, the deputy commander of the Hezbollah forces. And so it appears that the headquarters of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, as well as the Israeli military unit responsible for signals intelligence, like the National Security Agency in the United States, were both struck. It also appears that a lot of the infrastructure supporting the Iron Dome defense system was damaged. But we can't know because there's been a total blackout on the Israeli side about the consequences of this exchange of fire, by contrast with Hezbollah, which has described what the Israeli attacks accomplished in Lebanon.
Yeah. The other thing would be the nature of this type of conflict that they're having right now with Hamas, with Hezbollah, and they want some sort of escalation with Iran. Here is an article that an Israeli general is talking about that Israel will collapse within a year if the war of attrition against Hamas and Hezbollah continues. And how did you find this article? Do you think that if he's telling the truth, is the Netanyahu administration considering any sort of information coming out of these type of expertise?
I think the answer is no. You see a large number of segments of Israeli society counseling or arguing that for example, Netanyahu's government has no strategy for Gaza, and that the war is should be brought to an end. There should be a ceasefire. That's the position of the Israeli military, who are very smart people generally. And they know, as this general said, that Israel has never configured either its society or its armed forces for a war of attrition, which is what it is now engaged in. And I'll say a few things about that. Israel has been used to having short, victorious wars, six-day wars, however many days. This is something very different. And I note that Yoav Gallant, the commander of the Israeli Armed Forces, the defense minister, has called for retaking northern Israel from Hezbollah induced evacuations as part of the war aims of what's going on. But Israel is under terrible stress. The intelligence community, the Shin Bet, the domestic intelligence, internal security force, are arguing that there has to be a two-state solution for Israel to survive. Mossad is counseling that Israel cannot prevail in a war in the region, even though its government is attempting to provoke one. The IDF, as you noted, is saying Israel can't survive a continued war of attrition. The hostage families are saying that Netanyahu has basically sacrificed their family members for nothing, and they are demanding that he reverse course and at least pause the extermination campaign in Gaza to obtain the release of their loved ones. The ultra-Orthodox in Israel object to conscription, which has become necessary because of the fact this is a war of attrition, and the Israeli armed forces are not adequate to deal with it without additional manpower. The economy has contracted by about one-third. There have been 46,000 bankruptcies and small business closures. an unknown number of people, but probably well over 500,000 have emigrated from Israel. This is a society that is in very, very stressed. Now, the only thing that unites it, apparently, is a desire to massacre and exterminate Palestinians. That is costing Israel its international support. I think Israel has gone from being regarded as something of a problem in human rights terms to being seen as a pariah or perhaps even an outlaw. So both at home and abroad, Israel is in serious jeopardy. I think what the general was saying was, you know, this society could implode if we keep this up. I think he has to be taken seriously. He's basing his argument on realistic appraisals of what's happening, whereas Mr. Netanyahu seems to have almost a suicide impulse for his country.
From Nasrallah's speech, he was talking about peace talks and negotiation. Do you think in their mind they're still hoping for some sort of negotiations or peace talks?
Well, there have been no peace talks, of course, because Israel has never offered peaceful coexistence to the Palestinians. Never. It has always reserved its ultimate objective of expelling them from Palestine, murdering them or driving them out, whichever works. I think there have been no, I would say, of these talks that have been going on, proxy talks between Hamas and Israel, these are not talks about a ceasefire. These are talks about a hostage release, accompanied by a pause in the extermination campaign, not an end to it. There is no discussion of peace. The American proposal that President Biden rather ridiculously attributed to Mr. Netanyahu, who has never agreed with it, but which Hamas agreed to, you know, on July 2nd, is not a peace. It's at most a truce, and a very temporary one. And you can see that Mr. Netanyahu has no intention of recognizing any form of Palestinian self-determination when he not only insists on controlling the Philadelphia crossing to Egypt and thus exercising complete Israeli sovereignty in Gaza, which members of his cabinet insist should be resettled by Jews after the Palestinians have been removed. And he's simultaneously increasing ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. This is not a formula for peace. It's quite clear that it's a formula for ridding Palestine of its Palestinian population.
Yeah. Has Blinken been successful in calming down the government in Egypt when it comes to that conflict between Egypt and Israel in that corridor?
No, I don't think so. And in fact, I'm sorry to say that Secretary of State Blinken, if he were playing baseball, would have a zero batting average. He has no significant achievement to his name in this arena, and he is not seriously taken seriously by many in the region, which is why the director of the CIA, Mr. Burns, has been the primary person to go and do the negotiations and try to reassure people, using intelligence channels rather than the foreign ministries.
And when it comes to the conflict in Gaza, right now it doesn't seem that it would have any drastic change when it comes to their policy, the policy of the United States. But when it comes to two candidates right now, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, we know that Donald Trump, we partially know what would be his policy in Gaza, because in his first term, he showed us how he's going to react to anything coming from that region. And do you think that he's going to change, if he wins, he's going to have a different attitude, or we're going to see the same thing?
What I know that he has said on the subject of Gaza is that Israel should finish the job. What does finish the job mean? If it is finish the job the Israelis are attempting to finish, that means exterminating the people of Gaza. So I don't think there's any comfort to be had by international law, international community, in looking at what Mr. Trump might do were he elected. I think it's very clear at this point that the fact that the United States is in lockstep with Israel and would continue, apparently, under a Trump administration to be in lockstep with Israel is costing the United States, my country, a huge amount of international credibility and influence. I mean, how can you support a country that is enabling genocide with a good conscience?
Yeah. And the other candidate would be Kamala Harris. She gave an interview recently to CNN. I'm going to play it for you.
For example, would you withhold some U.S. weapons shipments to Israel? That's what a lot of people on the progressive left want you to do.
Let me be very clear. I'm unequivocal and unwavering in my commitment to Israel's defense and its ability to defend itself. And that's not going to change. But let's take a step back. October 7, 1,200 people were massacred. Many young people who were simply attending a music festival. Women were horribly raped. As I said then, I say today, Israel had a right, has a right to defend itself. We would. And how it does so matters. Far too many innocent Palestinians have been killed. And we have got to get a deal done. We were in Doha. We have to get a deal done. This war must end.
In the meantime,
and we must get a deal that is about getting the hostages out. I've met with the families of the American hostages. Let's get the hostages out. Let's get the ceasefire done.
But no change in policy in terms of arms and so forth.
No, we have to get a deal done. Dana, we have to get a deal done. When you look at the significance of this to the families, to the people who are living in that region, a deal is not only the right thing to do to end this war, but will unlock so much of what must happen next. I remain committed since I've been on October 8 to what we must do to work toward a two-state solution, where Israel is secure and in equal measure the Palestinians have security and self-determination and dignity.
I can tell you that after those remarks, which promised complete continuity with the Biden administration's enablement of genocide, some people have spoken to me and said there is no way they can vote for Kamala Harris because she is enabling genocide and appears to be comfortable with that. I noticed that when she spoke of the Palestinians, she said they were killed using the passive voice. She didn't say who had killed them. She towed the entire line of the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs in referring to rapes, which have been disproven. There is no evidence of that. That was a propaganda line from Israel in the beginning of this. So it's very clear which side she's on. And it is not the side of humanity, human rights, international law, or even American credibility abroad. What she said was calculated to appease donors in the United States. But I think she's at risk of losing a great number of potential voters if she continues on this line. She began to make a distinction that's very important. Israel has a right to defend itself against its neighbors, of course. No one questions that. Israel does not have a right to defend itself against a population it is abusing and against resistance to the occupation. In fact, under international law, Palestinians have a right to defend themselves against the occupation. And somehow this has been turned upside down. What Israel is doing is not defending itself. It is carrying out a program of ethnic cleansing. And it's doing so through genocide now, in addition to all the other methods it has used over the years. She began to make that distinction. Of course, the United States should help Israel defend itself against external actors. We should not be helping it to sustain apartheid or to carry out genocide. And I think unless she can more clearly reach that distinction, she's going to have trouble at the polls.
And the other thing that Dana was trying to force her, that talking about the weapons that the United States is sending to Israel, and she didn't answer that part, because that would be the key in terms of what Israel is doing.
Yes, this is, of course, everyone understands very well that the only way to stop this so-called war, campaign of extermination, if you will, and to stop Israel from threatening its neighbors with a wider war, is to cut off arms sales, temporarily at least, long enough to convince the Israeli government that we're serious. Instead, we are wringing our hands while sitting on them. We are, what I call, this is a kind of paraplegic policy. When you are paraplegic, you don't have the control of your hands and feet. You can talk. So lots of lofty talk and no action. And this has no credibility anywhere anymore. I'm sure Mr. Netanyahu loves it, but not many people outside Israel do.
Yeah. Before going to the conflict in Ukraine, I want to know your opinion on RFK Jr. joining Donald Trump. And we have other candidates like Jill Stein, Cornel West. They have a great platform and nobody's representing them. Nobody's helping them in this process.
Well, I don't know Mr. Kennedy, but I think he was supported by many donors as a potential spoiler on behalf of Trump. That is, the assumption was always that he would take more votes away from Trump than he would from whoever, the Joe Biden or now Kamala Harris as the Democratic candidate. So he's basically validating that theory, saying that he will remove his name from key states where he might be a spoiler and cost Donald Trump the election. But he's not removing his name from other states where perhaps he might be a spoiler in the other direction. So this is a liaison that is prompted by hatred of the Democrats, really, nothing else.
And getting to the point of getting to the conflict in Ukraine right now, I'm going to play a clip of Ursula von der Leyen. She's talking about the conflict, the policy, which I believe is the policy coming from the NATO headquarters, which would be the policy in Washington. And
argue to stop support for Ukraine. Do not argue for peace. They argue for appeasement and subjugation of Ukraine. So today I would like to address all those who, after 1,000 days of death and destruction, are asking sincerely, isn't it time for talks? It is first and foremost up to our Ukrainian friends to answer this question. We and them want the war to stop as soon as possible. But while many outside Europe are preoccupied only with the end of fighting, my position is that peace is not simply the absence of war. Peace is a settlement that makes war impossible and unnecessary. And therefore, we must put Ukraine in the condition of negotiating such peace. And this is why the integration of Ukraine in our European Union is for us at the heart of every peace effort.
That really is very interesting because it confuses two issues. One is peace in Europe, peace and stability in Europe, which requires a negotiation not between Ukraine and Russia, but precisely the negotiation that Russia demanded in December of 2021, namely a negotiation with the United States and NATO about a new order in Europe, a new security system in which Russia could feel unthreatened, and Western Europeans and Eastern Europeans alike could feel unthreatened. And that is the prerequisite for accomplishing what Ms. von der Leyen calls for, namely making war unnecessary. You cannot make war impossible, but you can make it unnecessary by removing the potential causes of it. The second issue, quite different, is the war between Ukraine and Russia. And here, she says, it's up to Ukraine to decide when and how to negotiate. Well, there was a negotiation in preparation in Qatar, which Ukraine apparently used as a deception in order to launch an incursion in Kursk in Russia, a region which brings back Russian memories of a Nazi army that was destroyed there. The reaction on the Russian side, which had been quite willing to talk, is we cannot talk anymore under these circumstances. So the negotiations have been set aside as a possibility while the Kursk incursion occurs. I suspect, although I'm not a military expert as such, that the Ukrainian invaders in Kursk will not make it out alive, that this will prove to have been a gross blunder strategically by Kyiv. It has some achievements to its credit. It has improved Ukrainian morale, which was very low. It has been approved and has encouraged Ukraine's foreign supporters, including the United States. And it probably was undertaken in part in anticipation of Mr. Zelensky's proposed visit to Washington to demand greatly increased support for Ukraine over a long period. These are achievements. But if, as most people now seem to expect, this fails and Ukraine loses its best forces while the Russians continue to advance in Donetsk at a ever more rapid pace, I don't think Ukraine will have gained anything. Certainly, it will not have improved its position at the bargaining table. And the negotiations may become ripe, but they will be on Russian terms, not on Western terms. And the issues really have not changed in the many months of this, many 2 years and more of this war. The issues are, can the Russian speakers in Ukraine enjoy security in their homes? And it became apparent they could not enjoy that security while the extremist faction in Western Ukraine was intent on denying them the right to speak their own language, educate their children in it, and communicate with government in Russian. That issue needs to be solved. It was solved at Minsk in two agreements, which were repudiated not by the Russians, but by Ukraine and the West. Second, there needs to be a ceasefire and a negotiated border between Russia and Ukraine that reflects what has happened on the battlefield. It is unrealistic to expect that Ukraine, under any circumstances, can recover the territories it has lost as a result of this entirely foolish and unnecessary and terribly costly war. And third, and most important of all, and this is where I agree with Ms. Fontelan, there needs to be a broad discussion of European security, so that Europe can remain at peace, and so that neither side in the divide between Russia and the EU, which she represents, is in fear of an attack by the other. This is what has to happen. It is a terrible, terrible shame that to make it happen, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians have had to die, and a lesser number of Russians, and the world has been put at the brink of a nuclear war.
It seems that the mastermind of this offensive on the Kursk region was London. And do we know what's going on in the United Kingdom and why they're getting so radical?
Well, it is a mystery wrapped in an enigma for me. I cannot understand anything other than this. It was an effort by the British authorities to force the United States to join in a wider campaign against Russia. And here I'll just make another point, and that is that the issue of deep strikes into Russia, which the British advocate and apparently facilitate, and the United States has been somewhat cautious about, is entirely irrelevant to the outcome of the war in Ukraine. Any strike into Russia will be answered by Russia, with a strike at least into Ukraine and possibly into NATO if things go to that direction. So this is potentially setting off World War III. It is also the case that the incursion in Kursk and the deep strikes do absolutely nothing for Ukrainian forces inside Ukraine, who are attempting to defend Ukrainian territory against increasing Russian advances. The Russians are accelerating their advance, not slowing it down. So this is a distraction, mainly for political purposes, to sustain the credibility of Ukraine, both to its own people and to its supporters in NATO.
And the other thing would be right now the position of Zelensky. It seems that he's not backing down. He's just asking for more weapons, more F-16s, more long-range missiles. Here is what CNN was talking about.
Of this visit from two of Ukraine's top officials is to try to press and convince the Biden administration to ease restrictions on the use of U.S. weapons against Russia and in Russia. So far, Ukraine is only allowed to use U.S. weaponry right across the border in a fairly small area. They want to be able to use some of the U.S. long-range weapons against priority targets inside of Russia, and that's what they're here for. They'll present a list of priority targets deeper inside Russia to the Biden administration in the hopes that U.S. will loosen or ease the restrictions on the use of U.S. weapons by Ukraine. Those two officials, Andriy Yermak, the head of the Office of the President of Ukraine, and Rustem Umerov, Ukraine's defense minister, will be here tomorrow for those meetings. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky made it clear why he believes the U.S. and others should ease those restrictions so they can hit longer-range targets inside of Russia.
Well, this appeals to the those in the United States and Britain and other places who think this war is all about hurting Russia. Those, as I just said, those long-range strikes are not going to do anything at all for the defense of Ukraine, except draw counterfire from Russia, further destruction of Ukrainian infrastructure, energy facilities, and an expansion of the war to even more areas in Ukraine, possibly over the border. Childish in a way. I mean, I can understand why Ukrainians are terribly, terribly committed to hurting Russia, but they really need to think rationally. What is this going to do for Ukraine? And it's all very well for Ukrainians to say, well, it's okay to risk World War III. Some of the rest of us don't think it's such a good idea.
The other thing would be, it seems that in the mind of Ukrainians or even the Biden administration, they're thinking if Russia takes some regions, they're going to give it back to Ukraine. Because as long as this war is going on and on, it would be much more difficult for them to negotiate with Russia.
Well, one of the explanations for the incursion in Kursk, which is based on the false assumption, I think, that Ukraine could hold Kursk, keep it, is that it would then be traded for Ukrainian territory that's currently controlled by Russia. But I think this is naive. And certainly, given the circumstances in which this incursion was launched, namely using an apparent commitment to negotiations as cover, as a deception, I think the prospects of such a negotiated trade-off are minimal. Certainly there is never going to be a recovery of Crimea, which, like the other areas in question, is predominantly Russian-speaking, and which has no desire to be part of Ukraine, something it made clear on numerous occasions before Russia actually annexed it in 2014. So I think this is very naive, and I think what Ukraine and the Western supporters of it are doing by prolonging this war is magnifying the losses Ukraine will suffer, not putting Ukraine in a position to recover much of anything.
And one of the points in the talks of Ursula von der Leyen, she said that the decision is Ukrainian have to make their decision on what would be the future of the country. But we know that without the help coming from NATO, they're not capable of doing anything. That's why how important is their action. The NATO position is important for the future of the conflict. But it doesn't seem that in their mind they're considering that.
Of course, Ukraine has to be at the table, and it has the right to decide for itself what sacrifices it may have to make to save itself. That is obvious. Then I totally agree with those who say no discussion of Ukraine without Ukraine, if we're talking about a negotiation with the Russians. But that is very different from offering Ukraine a blank check, which is what Ursula von der Leyen just did. So you say, it's up to Ukraine, and we're not going to say anything. You know, we're just going to keep helping Ukraine fight Russia because we like that. The Ukrainians can decide for themselves what they want to do, but we'll keep supplying them. That is exactly like handing the car keys to a drunk. It is very dangerous for the drunk. It is very irresponsible for whoever is handing the car keys to the drunk. So I don't agree that Ukraine alone should decide how this war ends. By the way, this war didn't start entirely over Ukraine. It started over NATO enlargement and a hostile posture. And finally, I would note that, ironically, the Ukrainian argument for long-distance strikes into Russia and the incursion in Kursk validate Russian concerns about the consequences of Ukraine becoming part of NATO. Because if Ukraine is part of NATO, there will be American and other Western weaponry on its territory. And we're seeing how much damage such weaponry can do to Russia. So I think we need to be realistic here. The war, this has almost totally been lost by Ukraine. Asking Ukraine to fight on is not going to accomplish anything. It is time for negotiations. It is unfortunate that the Russians, who were willing to negotiate, now seem unwilling to negotiate. And I think here we need to consider the importance of the Chinese peace plan and the fact that their special emissary, Ambassador Li Wei, is traveling throughout the BRICS, India, South Africa, other countries where the Chinese and Brazilian initiative is taken seriously, where the countries have cordial relations both with Kyiv and Moscow and can talk to both, looking for the convening of a peace conference. Now, you know, when and how that might happen is not yet decided by anybody. It's being put together, but it is very timely. And I think most of the world outside the NATO hardcore should welcome this, and does.
We had Jake Sullivan's visit to China. They were talking about that the main objective of this visit was to convince Chinese not to help Russia. And there may be some other reasons that nobody's talking about that, those reasons. But how did you find this visit?
Well, I think it's very helpful to have visits of this sort. I note that Mr. Blinken has failed in his several efforts at outreach to China. And once again, someone else is called upon to do what the Secretary of State normally would be asked to do. Mr. Sullivan is the first national security advisor to visit China in 8 years, which shows how badly relationships have deteriorated. I think the Chinese demonstrated they want to have an active dialogue with the United States. They want a cooperative relationship with America. The United States despite Mr. Sullivan's announcement of a small yard high fence policy with regard to export controls and technology transfer, has steadily expanded the yard and raised the fence. We have been very much on the offensive, tightening controls, elevating our confrontation with China on issues, while saying nice things about to the Chinese, but not about them. So this is a useful visit, but I don't think it appears to have accomplished anything except keeping lines of communication open. And in the end, while it is very good to talk, it matters much more what you talk about and what you say. And there's no evidence that we said anything new at all.
And the other issue between the United States and China would be in Taiwan. Do you see any sign that the United States is learning from what's going on in Ukraine or even in Gaza, not to escalate the situation in Taiwan?
I'm sorry to say no, but there are more and more people in the United States who make two points. One, that the American interest in defending Taiwan is not compelling. Taiwan is a robust democracy, an admirable society. It is a very successful society, and it would be a shame if that were to end. But taking a purely military approach to deterring China from finishing its civil war by taking Taiwan does not have much prospect of securing that society. And here, we are hearing more and more voices that point out that, in fact, the United States does not have the ability to defeat China in a battle over Taiwan. Taiwan is 7,000 or 8,000 miles away from the United States. We have to project power across the Pacific. The Chinese are right there. The technological advantages we once had militarily have largely disappeared. China's had, 70 some years to prepare for a battle over Taiwan, and it is 75 years. It has used that time effectively. So we hear now, not only is it stupid and very dangerous to get into a war with China over Taiwan, but we would likely lose. So there are voices being raised that say, wait a minute, let us reconsider this. And I would argue that a far more effective way of promoting the ideological interests we have in this very democratic society, becoming a model for China to some extent in the future, is best served by promoting peace in the Taiwan Strait and by using diplomatic means rather than military means to reduce the threat of Chinese invasion. To go back to what Ms. Fontelian said, we are in a position through diplomacy, as we demonstrated in 1972 with the Nixon trip to China, that we are in a position to use diplomacy to reduce the threat and make a war unnecessary for the Chinese. That is a far better protection than naval power. And by the way, with regard to naval power, it appears that the entire U.S. complement of active aircraft carriers are now engaged in the Middle East. There is not one in the Pacific, which demonstrates the limitations we now confront militarily. So I would argue, and it's not just because I'm a former diplomat, but because I think it makes sense for my country, we need to rediscover diplomacy as a means of reducing and eliminating threats, and not imagine that the only answer to threats is to deploy forces.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Pleasure to be with you, Nima, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.